we're going to get started. We don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to get moving anyway. And as soon as the next committee member walks in the room, we'll officially call a meeting to order. And so, Representative Westerberg, if you'd like to come to the stand and explain your bill, if you complete your presentation before we have a quorum, we can just put your bill on the table. You can leave, and we'll take care of it. Trust us after you leave. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Before we get started, there's an amendment, an A2 amendment that we need to add in order to put on the shape of bike.
And Representative Westerberg, that would be great if we had a quorum, but we don't.
All
so we
okay.
could. Oh, we do have a quorum plus one right now. So, with that, I'll officially call to order the Transportation Finance Committee. I would ask that Ms. Vaught note the roll. The minutes of March 28th have been included in your packet. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. The next thing that we're going to take up is House File 3202. Representative Westerberg, I'll move consideration of that bill. In addition, I believe the A2 amendment will be offered by Representative Magnus.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A2 amendment, including Section 3, Trunk Highway 60, construction on page 3 after line 27, a new section.
Thank you. Would you like to explain the amendment or like us to adopt it to get the bill?
Just adopt it.
All right. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And this is a really simple technical bill brought forward by the Department of Transportation. And basically what it does is it conveys some state land back to the United States Fish and Wildlife Service and some land to the city of Montevideo and provides for a turn back of part of State Highway 242 to the county in order to accomplish the goals that we're trying to do on Highway 65 in Anoka County. The amendment that we added on is simply a project that allows us to do some road construction with a partnership with the city or with the state of Iowa on Highway 60. And with that, members, we'll stand for questions.
And if I might, Representative Westerberg, I also have the A1 amendment. Is that something you'd like included in your bill as well?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. Sorry, I missed that amendment.
That's okay. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to House File 3202. Would you like to explain that amendment to the committee? Mr. Rudine, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudine with MnDOT Government Affairs. And the A1 amendment would add a turnback in the city of Wilmer. The former regional treatment center, I understand, is being sold for private development, and the city of Wilmer would like to take over jurisdiction of that trunk highway, and MnDOT is supportive. I do have copies of the resolution from the Wilmer City Council, which was adopted on the 20th of March, which is why this wasn't in the bill to begin with, but we're willing to add it at this point.
All right, are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Representative Magna.
Madam Chair, my concern is we just added a new Section 3 on this, and I don't want to see that section deleted. Do we need to amend this amendment to say Section 4 then?
Representative Magnus, on the bottom of the amendments it says to renumber the sections and sequence and correct the internal references, and I think that will suffice
Thank
to take
you.
Care of that problem.
Yeah.
Any additional questions on the A1 amendment? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reference to Legislative Route 242 removed. Is that the entire roadway that we're talking about being turned back?
Mr. Rudine.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes. The entire portion of Trunk Highway 242 would be turned back to Anoka County.
If you can explain...
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you explain what's going to happen there with 242?
Mr. Rudine.
That's my home area, so I'm concerned.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, this is between U.S. Highway 10 and Trunk Highway 65. Anoka County will take over jurisdiction, and it's my understanding that the highway is being reconstructed to a four-lane section, so this will help enable the county to access turnback funds and complete that reconstruction.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. In addition, to give you further insight on it, what we're doing here on this stretch of Highway 65 is 242 is actually going to go up and over 65. It's an incredible project, and it's been in the making for quite some time, and thanks to the help from the Transportation Committee and Transportation Finance here, we've been able, and MnDOT and many players, we've been able to get this done, the city, county, federal, and it's an exciting project, but the whole project is in place to be completed and handled except for this little stretch of turnback from 242 on Highway 65 to the Coon Rapids side of the project, and once this is in place, it's all pretty much done.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions? No, I can't remember. Did we vote on the A1 amendment?
No, not the A1.
Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Now, we have the bill as amended in front of the committee. Are there any additional questions or comments? Representative Westerberg, anything to add?
No, Madam Chair. I would appreciate your help and support.
All right. Anybody in the audience that would like to speak in opposition to House File 3202 as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of the bill as amended say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The bill is on its way to the General Indeed. Register.
All support. Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
The next item on our agenda will be a presentation by Randall O'Toole. He contacted me a couple of weeks ago. I was making a presentation at St. John's last night and offered us the opportunity to hear his presentation. He has recently completed some research relative to affordable housing, so he's going to add some information about that topic as well as rail and transit. In addition, I did provide him with some a copy of the March 8th letter that was received from the FDA to the commissioner regarding the North Star project, and he will likely be willing to answer some questions as time allows relative to that as well. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be here. My name is Randall O'Toole, and I live in Oregon, and I've been inspired by Oregon's rail transit endeavors to investigate rail transit. I have a couple of things to say in the interest of full disclosure. First of all, I'm a rail nut. My hero is James J. Hill, and it's not just because he built the first transcontinental railroad ever built without public subsidies. I just love trains, and so you'll see a lot of pictures of trains in my slideshow. And the second disclosure is that I'm a nerd. I love numbers, and you'll see a lot of charts that are based on a lot of numbers. When I look at a question like rail transit or affordable housing or any other question, I gather all the data I can find going back as far as I can for as many different areas as I can. And last year...
Madam Chair,
Representative Hayes?
Mr. O'Toole represent the taxpayers later, or what are we looking at here?
Let me tell you that last year I published a report called Rail Disasters 2005, and I wrote the report, and the Taxpayers League of Minnesota published it. I don't represent them, but they did agree with their conclusions of the report, so they published this report, and I've since updated the data. This report is based on data from 1982 to 2003, and the charts I'll be showing you is based on data updated to 2004. Now, we all know that about 25 cities in America have some form of rail transit. And I looked at every city that had rail transit up until 2003, which means I haven't really got much data on Minneapolis or Houston yet. We know that Chicago, of course, has the elevated, and it has commuter trains. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the purple line on this chart, transit ridership has dramatically dropped since the early 1980s. It's mainly because, and we'll see this over and over again, it costs so much to maintain rail transit that you can't afford to keep your bus service up. And so you end up cutting back on the bus service, and it hurts transit riders. We see this over and over again. St. Louis recently built a light rail system, and in 2003 they doubled their miles of light rail system. They added a new light rail line, effectively, that doubled the miles. And you can see, if you look at the thin red line here with the little hash marks on it, like a railroad tracks, that's the number of miles of light rail that are in operation by year. And you can see in 2001, they effectively doubled the miles of light rail and got no new light rail riders, and they got a decrease in bus riders. And then in 2003, they added a few more miles. Again, no new rail riders and another decrease in bus riders. So this is a pattern we see over and over again. Rail is so expensive that we end up cutting our bus service. We don't get a lot of new riders. We lose a lot more riders than we get. Houston, Texas. Houston had a great bus system. It was one of the fastest growing ridership, had one of the fastest growing riderships of any transit system in the country. Their bus ridership was growing much faster than driving was growing in Houston. And then they decided to build a light rail line. Now this light rail line is now known for taking cars off the road about one every 4 days, because it's known as the wham-bam tram, because it's involved in a collision every 4 days. Now they always say, almost every single collision, they say, well, it was the auto driver's fault. But if you build a light rail in the streets, well, you're going to, it has 100,000 to 300,000 pound vehicles in the same streets as 3,000 pound vehicles, that you're just asking for trouble. Now the interesting thing is, in the first year of operation, they carried about 5 million light rail riders, and they lost about 5 million bus riders. So they had a net gain of only a few 100,000 riders, meaning more than 95% of all the riders of the light rail were just people who had been previously taking the bus. They did not really take any automobiles off the road except for the ones that they demolished. We want to talk about rail transit disasters. The mother of all rail disasters is Los Angeles. In the early 1980s, a group of people, experts they thought, decided to plan a rail system for Los Angeles. Now, if you look at the blue line on this, in the early 1980s, you see bus ridership was growing really, really fast because they were keeping fares low. They were offering excellent bus service to the core area where they had a lot of low-income people and minorities. And then they decided to start building rail. And in about 1985, they carried almost 600 million riders. They started building rail, and because they were putting all their money into rail and they had significant cost overruns, which almost every rail project has, they ended up cutting back on the bus service, and ridership dropped by 1995 by 100 million riders. That's almost 20% of all the riders just stopped riding the bus. And they started opening up rail, but rail did not carry anywhere near that many riders. Well, there was a group called the Bus Riders Union that was represented by the NAACP. It was a group of black and Hispanic residents who were upset that their bus service had been cut in order to build white rail into white middle-class neighborhoods. And they sued and got the transit agency to agree to buy hundreds of new buses and restore bus service to those neighborhoods. And you can see, after about 1996, bus ridership did increase again, and there's some rail ridership, but the total rail ridership is minuscule compared to the bus ridership. The latest rail line that opened in Los Angeles is carrying only half its projected ridership. The transit agency didn't even want to build it, but because of politics, they had to build it anyway. Now that's the mother of all rail disasters. Today, the biggest disaster is San Jose. San Jose does not have a distinctive downtown. Without having a big downtown, there's really not much need for transit. Transit is downtown oriented. San Jose does have a bus system. When they opened up their bus system, they did what everybody else does. When they took over from the private operators, they started offering much improved service. They bought new buses. They doubled transit ridership in just a few years. And then they decided to start building rail transit. In 1981, they opened their first line in about 1987, and they got a few new riders, and then doubled their line over the next few years, didn't get much more ridership, and then they're funded mainly out of a sales tax. And when the recession hit in 2001, sales tax revenues declined. Now, if sales tax revenues declined by 10%, you would think you'd have to cut your service by 10%. But no, half of their costs were debt service on the bonds for their rail transit projects. So that meant they couldn't cut the debt service, so that meant they had to cut transit service by more than 20%. In fact, they ended up cutting it by 30%, And if you look at transit ridership after 2001, it just plummeted. It fell by 35% in 3 years. A huge decline, and it's hurting low-income people the most. The relatively wealthy people, you know, they can still drive around in their SUVs, but the people who are transit dependent are seriously hurt by the huge cuts that they've had to make because of the being overburdened by light rail debt. Now, they're actually going to the voters this fall and asking for more sales taxes to help compensate, but they're not going to use that to operate the system. They're going to use that to build more transit, more rail transit that they can't afford to operate. Dallas, another city that's often been declared a light rail success. And in fact, if you look at the numbers here, you see that bus ridership was growing pretty fast, and then they started building rail transit. Bus ridership leveled off. They opened up the first light rail line, and you can see, again, the thin line with the hash marks is the number of miles of light rail. They did get a few new riders when they opened up the first line, but then they opened up a second line, and again, no new riders. Bus ridership declined. They got a few slight increase in rail riders, but net, virtually no new riders. And you can see the green line, it's hard to see on these screens, but there's a green line at the bottom. They have a commuter train between Fort Worth and Dallas, which would be like between Minneapolis and St. Paul, carries almost no people at all compared to the total amount of traffic in the region. The one city in America that I think everybody agrees rail transit serves adequately is New York, especially Manhattan and to some degree Brooklyn. And actually, they have rail transit on Staten Island, but that's pretty much of a failure. But the interesting thing is, if you look at the numbers between 1985 and about 1994, there was a huge drop in ridership because jobs were suburbanizing just like everywhere else. And while people were still taking the train to get to jobs in Manhattan, Manhattan only has about 20% of the jobs in the New York urban area. And so a lot of people, their jobs were moving and they were switching to automobiles. In 1994, the transit agency lowered transit fares. It was a complex system where they offered longer transfers, longer times to transfer. You could transfer from subways to buses, which you couldn't do before for free. They had a fixed fare. They had a whole bunch of ways of reducing fares. And they managed to recover their transit ridership. But since 2001, ridership has been essentially flat. They are now building a new subway in New York. It is 8 miles long. It is $2.1 billion, not for the 8 miles, but for every mile. $16.8 billion for the whole subway, 8 mile long subway. It's two blocks away from an existing subway. It's like, why are you doing this? You're saving people 30 seconds of their time to walk two blocks, and it's really not going to carry any more riders. It's just going to carry people who would otherwise have taken the existing subway. I'm sure you've all been to Washington, D.C. They have a wonderful subway system, especially wonderful for tourists. You can get around to all the museums. You can get around to all the offices. Get around to all the downtown areas. But the interesting thing is, it really isn't that wonderful for Washington, D.C. people. Now, the people who use it, they'll tell you it's wonderful. But if you look at ridership, in the early 1990s, they were having to cut bus service because the rail transit costs so much. One hidden cost of rail transit is about every 20 to 25 years you have to completely rebuild the line. The first rail lines in New York or in Washington were built about 1975. And so we're starting to come due and they have to come in and replace the escalators, replace the cars, replace the rails, replace the electrical facilities. They don't have the budget for it. They don't have any money for it. They say they're going to need to spend $10 billion over the next 10 years on reconstruction and maintenance, and they don't have the money. So while they do have some ridership, they have these serious problems. They can't extend service anymore. They can't keep bus service going. The most interesting set of numbers came from the census. These are census numbers. The red line is the number of people who say that they take transit to work. Notice between 1970 and 1990, it went way up. Between 1990 and 2000, Washington, D.C. The D.C. metropolitan area gained more than 100,000 jobs. Every single one of those commuters drove to work, and more than 20,000 people who were taking the train or the bus in 1990 switched to driving by the year 2000. So It works for tourists. It doesn't work for commuters. An interesting picture in San Francisco where they spent billions of dollars building the BART line. They've made the bus riders in the San Francisco, Oakland area extremely angry because they've cut money for buses in order to build these BART lines. There's been a lawsuit filed just last year, late last year, like the Los Angeles lawsuit filed by a bus riders union. Their metropolitan planning organization is known as the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. They agreed to fund billions of dollars for more BART lines, but wouldn't fund millions of dollars for new bus lines to minority districts. The BART lines were expected to cost $100 to get one person out of their car onto the BART. The bus service would have cost a dollar or two to get people out of their car onto the bus, and they wouldn't fund the buses because the BART was too expensive. You look at the ridership figures, total transit ridership in 1982 was way more than it is today because we cut way back on buses and bus trips have dramatically fallen in order to build the BART, and so we have a loss in ridership. Now what we've gained is people riding 20 miles from distant suburbs to downtown San Francisco instead of people riding 3 or 4 miles in San Francisco, 4 or 5 miles in San Francisco or Oakland. So we're getting more passenger miles, but the total ridership is dropping, and we're essentially, again, subsidizing white middle-class suburbanites and cutting service to lower-class, low-income, especially low-income blacks and Hispanics and other minorities. Now, I know I'm throwing a lot at you, but there are just 25 cities that have rail transit, and the story is the same over and over again. Baltimore built a heavy rail line that carries almost nobody. They built a light rail line that carries almost nobody. Again, total ridership was greater in 1988 than it is today. If you look over the whole 20-year period, ridership is essentially flat. So they invested all this money and got very little. Numerous cities were in the same position as Washington, D.C. I mentioned that Washington, D.C. has gained all these jobs, but they lost transit riders. Chicago has lost 40,000 transit riders. Philadelphia, 35,000. Many other cities. In fact, on the average, cities with bus-only transit gain far more riders than cities with rail transit. And on the average, cities with rail transit gained almost no riders. Many of them gained and many of them lost. But cities with bus-only transit gained lots and lots of riders. Now we come to my hometown, Portland. Some people call it Mecca because it's where everybody points to as the example of how rail works and how all of these ideas work. And if you look at the numbers, ridership is growing. It's one of the few cities where transit ridership is growing. It's not going as fast as driving, and it's not going as fast as it was in the days before they started building rail transit, but it is growing. San Diego and Boston are two other cities where transit ridership is growing with rail transit. But again, one important question is, what percentage of people are taking transit to work? That's the blue line on this chart. It shows that in 1980, before they started building rail transit, they had 10% of all commuters were taking transit to work. And then they started building rail transit. They did the same thing as they did everywhere else. They had to cut their bus service. They had to raise bus fares. They lost bus riders. Notice the huge decline in bus ridership and transit ridership between 1980 and 1990. And so the percentage of people fell to about 6%, the percentage of commuters taking transit to work. Now, it increased again from 1990 to 2000, but we still have not recovered to the rates in 1980. Just think what it would be like today if they had just built bus, just ran buses, and had not changed to rail. Transit ridership would have increased instead of decreased in the 80s, and we'd be carrying maybe 12 or 14% of commuters. One of the interesting stories is they built a rail line to the airport. I don't want to say nobody rides it, but one day they only had one passenger that left the station. It was a coyote. Now, coyotes like to go where they know they're not going to encounter any people, so this coyote felt safe getting aboard the light rail train that was leaving the airport. Rail transit is so expensive that it would actually, in most cases, be cheaper to give people a ride in a stretch limousine. The cost per rider for, to get one person out of their car to ride the North Star Transit, the North Star commuter line, is estimated to be $50 to get one person out of their car for one trip. $50 a trip. It's hard to imagine that anybody can think that that's cost effective. And in fact, even the advocates, some of the advocates say it's not cost effective. John Fregonisi was the head of transportation planning for Portland's Metro, which is Portland's Met Council, and he's since gone into the private sector, going around telling everybody how to build rail transit and build neighborhoods like Portland. He works for a consulting firm named Calthorpe Fregonisi. You probably heard of Peter Calthorpe. But he told the Wisconsin newspaper, light rail is not worth the cost. You can read it. The purpose of rail is to redevelop your neighborhoods to higher densities. The problem with that is, even if you support the idea of redeveloping neighborhoods to higher densities, which I don't, it doesn't work. According to Robert Cervero, a professor of planning at the University of California at Berkeley, who supports the idea of developing neighborhoods to higher densities, and Samuel Sesto, who is a consultant with Parsons Brinckerhoff, which is the main consulting firm, I'm sure you are aware, that deals with rail transit, they say that rail transit does not lead to new investments. It might redistribute growth around the city, but most of that redistribution is to downtowns. Suburban areas, you don't get new investments. Take a look at my hometown of Portland. They built their first light rail line in 1986, and the city immediately zoned everything along the line to high-density transit-oriented development, just like Minneapolis has done. 10 years later, they sat down and looked at the maps, and they found no, zero, nada, not a single development had been built along the line. And they asked the developers why. And they said, people don't want to live in high-density developments. There's no market for it. So the city said, well, what can we do to get you to build it? And they said, subsidize it. So the apartment building you see here received about $500,000 in subsidies. The city bought the land and resold it to the developers for half price and gave them 10 years of property tax breaks and a bunch of other subsidies to get this high-density development next to a light rail line. This is called the Round. It's around the station. You can kind of see in the drawing, there's tracks in the middle. It was supposed to be a high-density commercial, retail, and housing project. They gave it $10 million of subsidies. It got half built, and then the developer went bankrupt because he couldn't find anybody willing to finance a project without any parking. Since then, they've given another developer more subsidies. They've come in and finished parts of the project, and they left the rest of it open for parking. As long as there's lots of parking, you can make transit-oriented development work if you give it some other subsidies, but you have to have the parking. You take away the parking, it's a failure, which means it's not really transit-oriented development, it's automobile-oriented development. There's another development, it's right next to Portland's light rail line, the East Side light rail line. In fact, it's just a few blocks from where I grew up. This was a state land, it used to be a Department of Motor Vehicles. I got my driver's license here when I was 30 years old. And they sold it to the developers at below market prices. They gave them 10 years of property tax breaks, and they built this high-density development with one parking space for every one and a half housing units. That's not enough, of course. So you can see the cars parked here. They're parked in the no-parking fire lane. See the cars parked here? They're parked on the sidewalk. The managers know that they have to let people park in the no-parking fire lanes and on the sidewalk because otherwise they'll move out. So you have to have parking. Here's another development. You can see there's a four-story construction. The bottom story is supposed to be retail shops. The upper three stories are all apartments. Right behind me is the light rail station. There's a huge light rail parking lot next door, but it's only for the light rail park and ride station. Every single shop you see in the picture is vacant. Every single one. Because there's no parking for retail, and the people who live there are just not enough people to make retail go. Here's the parking lot. Here's the sign that says you can only park there if you are using the light rail, not if you're going shopping. So not a single shop is open. This one is by the airport. This is actually where the Coyote got on board. This is 120 acres. It was given to Bechtel Corporation. Bechtel built this Light Rail on a no-bid contract. They got $100 million and 120 acres, but the city zoned the acres for small box retail. The problem is nobody wants a small box retail next to the airport. So they spent millions of dollars on infrastructure, streets, sidewalks, parks. They've had two light rail stations that are closed, and yet it's amusing because every single train stops there and opens the doors. Nobody gets on or off except for a coyote now and then, and nothing happens. Finally, the city, after 4 years of nothing happening, they rezoned it, and an IKEA is going to move there. I just can't wait to see all the people taking their furniture home on the light rail from the IKEA. You all know what an IKEA is, don't you? Yeah. Have those here, I hope. Good Scandinavian store. Now, I'm not saying that light rail is bad for business. There are some businesses that benefit from light rail. Portland Max is what the name of our light rail is. I'm not sure you would necessarily want to have those businesses in your neighborhood, but when Portland built its second light rail line, the Oregonian reported that there was a major war between the gangs over who was going to control the drug traffic on the lines. Now, the advocates of rail transit will tell you that light rail has had the greatest increase in ridership of any of the major forms of transit. This is bus, commuter rail, heavy rail, and light rail. What they don't tell you is that to get that increase, they've had a huge increase in light rail miles and light rail service. This is vehicle revenue miles. In other words, to get a 90% increase in ridership, they've had to have a 180% increase in service. Well, that's what you call diminishing returns. When you're doubling your service and only getting 50% more, you know, you add more and more, and you get a little more every time you add more and more, but a little bit less for every new one you add. It's just not adding up to sensible transportation. The rail advocates are also proud to tell you that during a few years in the late 1990s, transit ridership was growing faster than driving. You know, transit is gaining market share. Pretty soon everybody will be riding transit. But the actual numbers show, if you look at this, this is the miles of urban driving versus the miles of transit trips in the country. Transit ridership is so low, it's really insignificant. Out of the last 20 years, yes, transit ridership grew faster than miles of driving in 6 of the last 21 years. In the other 15, driving grew much faster than transit. Even if transit were growing twice as fast as driving, let's say it were growing 2% a year and driving is growing at 1% a year, how long would it take for transit to even carry 10% of all passenger travel in our cities? It would take more than 100 years. That's because transit is just insignificant. Twice nothing is still nothing. Now, we talked about how the real reason why they want rail transit is to redevelop communities. This is all a part of what's called smart growth or growth management planning. Smart growth is based on encouraging people to live in higher densities, discouraging, or at least not encouraging, low densities. They say they're not encouraging, but really they're discouraging with urban service boundaries and so on and so forth. And the main effect of smart growth is not to change people's travel habits. The main effect is to make housing unaffordable. This house is in Houston. It sold last year. It's a 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath house with a large family room, a 2-car garage, and it's on a 1/4-acre lot. It's about 10 years old. It sold last year for $150,000. Houston has no zoning, it has no grass management, it has no smart growth, and so home builders can build houses there really cheap, and they're good quality houses. You can buy a brand new house of the same dimensions for $160,000. In a neighborhood that has lots of parks, has lots of bike paths and pedestrian paths, a beautiful place to live if you want to live in Houston. Now, that's $150,000 in Houston. If you wanted the same house in Fargo, it would be $200,000. If you want the same house in Madison, $300,000. These numbers come from Coldwell Banker, which does an annual survey of the cost of a house that I described, 4 bedrooms, 2.5 baths, et cetera, et cetera. Minneapolis, $400,000. Boulder pioneered this growth management planning in 1967. They're up to $550,000. San Jose started in 1974. That same house would cost you $1.1 million in San Jose. And in San Francisco, we're up to $1.3 million. Now, my hometown of Portland, this is the kind of house that's being built today. This is known as a skinny house. It's 15 feet wide. You can see it's got a garage, a front door. It's got two bedrooms, two baths. It's not the kind of house we were talking about before. It's about half as big. It's 1,500 square feet instead of 2,200 square feet. Two fewer bedrooms. Really no backyard. Mostly no side yard, obviously. Those houses are selling in Portland for $200,000. They're being popping up all over the place because they get huge tax breaks to put them in. Nobody really wants them, but housing is so unaffordable that people can't, don't have much choice if they want a single family home. You can look at what's happened to housing prices in various Midwestern cities. Look at how Minneapolis has taken off in the last few years. This is inflation-adjusted price of a median value home. And you can see, Minneapolis has taken off, and that means you are less competitive when somebody's deciding, are we going to locate in Minneapolis or Omaha, or Minneapolis or Iowa City, or Minneapolis or Austin? They're looking at housing prices, and they're saying, we're going to have to pay our workers a lot more to be in Minneapolis. We think we're going to go somewhere where it's more affordable. And this is what we're seeing in Portland. Portland had the highest unemployment rate in the nation for about a year and a half at the beginning of this recession. Second highest was San Jose. So when you start manipulating the land market to try to manipulate the transportation market, to try to get people out of their cars and on the rail transit, you impose huge costs on people. I call it the planning penalty. Essentially, it's a tax. You're taxing first-time home buyers and giving that money to wealthy homeowners. It's taxing the poor and giving it to the rich. I estimate that the tax is about $32,000 per median value home in the Twin Cities. It's about $60,000 in Portland, so you haven't caught up with my hometown yet, but you're getting there. And San Francisco, $850,000. That includes Marin County and San Mateo County, as well as City of San Francisco itself. Annually, last year, the people throughout the nation had to pay $275 billion in extra costs because of planning-induced housing shortages. Most of that was in 12 states, 95% of it, in fact, was in 12 states that have most of the most strict planning. You got away with $1.6 billion in costs, extra costs in the Twin Cities. No other city in Minnesota so far has problems, although Rochester, housing prices are going up and they're going to have affordability problems soon. Portland was $2.6 billion. California, half of all the unaffordable housing is in California. Half of the cost of unaffordable housing is in California, $136 billion. It's interesting to compare the regions with the most unaffordable housing with the regions that have growth management. The strictest laws versus the weakest laws, the most unaffordable versus somewhat unaffordable versus affordable housing, the maps are practically identical. And I'm the last one to say that correlation equals causation, that just because you see these two things on a map that one causes the other. But it's pretty clear when you look at the numbers that it is true that the growth management plans get put into effect first and then housing prices go up. I'm not the only one to say so, but Edward Glaser, the professor of economics at Harvard University, who was recently featured in the New York Times as revolutionizing urban economics, has come to the same conclusion. Government regulation is causing housing prices to go up. Wherever we see unaffordable housing, restrictive zoning is ubiquitous, he says. He estimated that in the greater Boston area, housing prices are increased by about $156,000 because of government regulation. My estimate, using a totally different method, is about $170,000. So we're both within about 10% of each other. That, I think, really shows that this is a problem. What should we be doing instead of building rail transit? What should we be doing instead of trying to manipulate people's lives and forcing people to live in higher densities when they don't want to, and making housing unaffordable for people who want to live in single-family homes? There's a lot of things we can do that are a lot more cost-effective that can significantly reduce congestion. The number one thing is coordinating traffic signals. You've all been frustrated driving down some arterial that has stoplights, and you end up having to stop at every light or every other light because the signals aren't coordinated. Guess what? For 1% of the cost of rail transit, you can coordinate lots and lots of traffic signals and reduce congestion, far more congestion and far more air pollution than that rail transit line will reduce. So it's less than 1% of the cost to get the same kind of results. Another thing you've already begun to experiment with is high occupancy toll lanes. Low occupancy vehicles can use those lanes by paying a toll. Your hot lanes are very successful. These lanes are in California. They've been going for almost 10 years. There's lots of data on them. We find out that people of all income classes are using them. It's not just the wealthy. And you know if you use it, you pay a couple dollars, or you sit in traffic 20 minutes extra. And so you have a choice. But the interesting thing is that the people on the free lanes, the ones that are jammed up on the far right here, those people know that they're getting home faster because one-third of the traffic that used to be on those lanes is now being carried on the hot lanes. So these are very successful. They're paid for entirely out of tolls. And yet there's other solutions.
Wrong. They're not paid for entirely out of tolls. But go ahead.
Oh, well, except for the right-of-way. All the construction has been paid for out of tolls. The right-of-way was given to them. You're right. But I bet even that can be paid for out of tolls. And we now know that Indiana Tollway sold their toll road for sold 75-year lease on it for $3.8 billion, and it included requirements that they expand capacity in many different places and maintain it for 75 years. Toll roads will pay for themselves. They can pay for themselves, just like highways generally have paid for themselves in the past. There's something else they can do about congestion. You all know what cruise control is. You might have heard of laser-guided cruise control, also known as adaptive cruise control. This is where your cruise control has a laser beam that fixes on the car in front of you, and then it keeps your distance from that car to the exact same distance. Now, this kind of congestion, I was driving through St. Paul yesterday, and all of a sudden, all the traffic slowed down. We found out there was a two-car collision. It was just a very mild collision. They were both on the shoulder. There was a police car on the shoulder. There was no obstruction in the main lanes of traffic, but everybody slowed down. The reason why is, at 60 miles an hour, a freeway lane has a capacity of carrying 2,000 cars an hour. But at 40 miles an hour, it only has a capacity of carrying about 1,500 cars an hour. So if you're carrying, say, 1,800 cars an hour, and there's an accident and somebody slows down to below 40 miles an hour, suddenly the traffic exceeds the capacity. And even if the obstruction goes away, you can't get back up to speed for hours until the traffic falls below the capacity at that speed, falls below 1,500 or whatever the traffic is at the speed you're going. But if we were going at about 10 miles an hour, so the capacity is really, really low. Well, research by traffic engineers at the University of Minnesota has shown that if only 20% of cars on the road have adaptive cruise control, that kind of congestion is going to go away. Won't solve all congestion, but it will solve a lot of congestion. It would be cheaper for the state of Minnesota to give adaptive cruise control to 20% of the drivers in the Twin Cities than it would be to build the North Star Commuter Rail. And it will do far more to relieve congestion. So if relieving congestion is your goal, there are some really low-cost ways of doing it that beat North Star, light rail, whatever. If carrying transit, improving transit service for transit-dependent people or just people who don't want to drive is your goal, there's some low-cost ways of doing that. The city of Las Vegas has had the fastest-growing transit ridership in the country. They contract out all their transit to private operators. So they operate it at half the cost of transit operations that are done by public agencies. And they're able to provide really intensive transit service. But why even do that? Why not just open up your city to jitney transit? Here's a jitney operator in Colorado. The state of Colorado allowed a jitney service to operate on East Colfax Avenue, which you may know is the main drag in Denver. And for $1 a ride, they'll carry people, they'll get them there faster than the bus, which is $1.25. They'll pick you up at your corner, drop you off at your destination, It's a very effective service, and they can make money doing it. Opening up your city to jitney traffic, jitney transit, will allow transit to operate on a for-profit basis instead of a for-loss basis, and you won't need to have the subsidies at all. There's lots of different ideas. New lanes, traffic improvements, all kinds of things that can be done. What I think the Metro Council should do is look at all the different options and say, how many hours of delay is this option going to save us, and how much is it going to cost? And ultimately, what does it cost to save 1 hour of people's time by using this method? Here's an analysis that was done by the city of Denver, by Denver's transit agency, for new freeway lanes versus bus high occupancy vehicle lanes versus commuter rail. You can see the new freeway lanes reduce the most hours and cost the least amount of money. So it costs about $2.33 to save 1 hour with the freeway lanes. It costs $8 to save an hour with the commuter rail. The transit advocates are very proud that they convinced Denver voters to adopt the high-cost, least-effective solution in Denver. But I'm not. I don't think that should be done everywhere. Here's a matrix. It just has a whole bunch of different things, and it has the cost per hour saved. I recommend that the Metro Council be told, rank all the different possible transportation improvements in the Twin Cities by cost per hour saved. Just calculate that. It's easy to calculate with their transportation models. Rank them all, and then pick the ones that are the lowest cost until you run out of money. It's a very simple method of doing it. It's actually the way that transportation engineers have done it for years. It's only when the planners got involved and decided to build rail transit because we need to get people out of their cars that we stopped doing it that way. Well, I'm sorry to have taken so much of your time. I don't know if we have time for questions and answers, but that's really the gist of my message. We need to be cost-effective. I can imagine a situation where rail transit might be cost-effective, and in that case, I'd be glad to endorse it. I just haven't found one yet.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole. Are there any questions? Representative Earhart.
Can anybody remember the definition of demagogue?
Representative Earhart, you're going to be nice today, I hope.
We know where your dog is, Representative
Earhart. Do you have any questions?
I have to say the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and again and expecting a different result.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. O'Toole. Can you, you said that you're willing to endorse something that's cost effective. Can you give us some of your thoughts on the numbers that we've seen from the Hiawatha corridor, and just give us your thoughts on Hiawatha? You've given us a lot of examples of where, in your opinion, rail is failing. Just give us your sense of Hiawatha.
Well, I haven't looked at the 2005 numbers for Hiawatha, and I probably should have prepared myself by doing that, but I've looked at the numbers published nationally, and the Federal Transit Administration is about a year and a half behind always in their publication of numbers. So I will tell you that the numbers that I looked at before Hiawatha was built showed that it was dramatically cost ineffective, and even if they carried more than twice as many riders as they expected to carry, there's no way it would be cost effective. What makes it especially cost ineffective is the fact that they've totally disrupted this traffic signal coordination on Hiawatha Avenue, which has actually made it far more congested rather than less congested, even if they manage to get a few people out of their cars. I don't think the goal of transit should be to get somebody out of their car. I think the goal of transit should be to move people cost effectively. Number one, we should serve the people who can't drive because they need the mobility. And if deciding to try to get people who can drive out of their cars hurts them, as it has seems to have done in the vast majority of rail cases, it's really detrimental. So my guess is that they did not do more than double their expected ridership. I've heard that they've done surveys and said most of the people riding it were formerly driving, and that's a good thing, but they didn't survey the bus riders who are no longer riding the bus because it cut back on bus service, which, of course, the Metro Transit has done. So overall, the early numbers I saw were that total transit ridership has not been increasing enough to justify the Hiawatha line. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Citizen Larson.
It provides me your perspective.
Any additional questions? Representative Earhart. Nice to see you. Oh, you're going to be nice today.
Well, I found it.
I wouldn't be sure about that.
Hey, I won't be nice. He doesn't have to be nice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if you think that the sole determinant of where one buys a house in which city is determined by the price, and there's no other factors involved here. Like, you are isolating whether I should sell my house and move to Houston because it's so cheap down there to buy a house and pocket the balance of the million that I'll get for my house.
Well, that's actually an excellent question.
What are the other determinants that someone decides they're going to live in Minneapolis versus Houston or Portland or
right.
New York or Boston?
The main determinant that decides where people live are family, friends, and jobs. It's not housing affordability. That makes housing what economists call an inelastic good. It's like salt. If the amount of salt available declined by 10%, the price would more than double because everybody still needs salt even if there's less salt available. And this is what happens with housing. A small decline in the availability of new housing leads to a huge increase in the price of new housing. And housing prices are like the tide that lifts all boats. When the price of new housing goes up, the price of existing housing goes up as well. So you get a dramatic decline in affordability when you make any minor restrictions on housing availability. And the effect of that is not to change people's minds about where to live, but it is to change employers' minds about where to locate. You've got a job somewhere, you have to pay what it takes to live there, but the employer is going to say, wait a minute, when we next open our next factory, when we open our next office building, we're not going to locate in San Jose or Portland. And if it keeps going the way it is, we're not going to locate in the Twin Cities because we can't afford to pay the workers what it takes to live here in a decent house. We're going to go to Houston, we're going to go to Austin, we're going to go to Raleigh, we're going to go to Omaha, where people can afford to live.
Well,
Senator Earhart.
Madam Chair, if you're based on that, where the manufacturers are building, where the housing is cheap, and you want to go to Mexico or China, India, that's where the wages are low and the housing is low and the manufacturing costs are low. So we should all bail out of here and head for Mexico, which has nicer weather, or something like that.
Well, I'm not offering recommendations for where you should live, but you may have noticed that a lot of employers are moving their factories to Mexico because it's more affordable. But the point I'm making is that your city is competing, your region and your state is competing with other regions and states around the country. And employers are deciding where to locate, and they're going to use a lot of different factors in making that decision, but one of them is housing affordability. It's worth noting that the San Francisco Bay Area and California as a whole has been losing population in the last 5 years because housing is so unaffordable there. It's not losing population because people want affordable housing. It's losing population because there's no jobs. There's no jobs because employers aren't going to locate where they can't afford to pay their workers. So if you want slow growth, if you want the jobs to go somewhere else, if you want to preserve Minnesota the way it is, which is what a lot of my environmental friends want, then maybe the thing to do it is to make it so unaffordable that you can't afford to live here unless you already own your own house. And that's a nice way of thinking about it. I think it's very unfair to the people who don't own their houses, whether they live here and are renting, or they're thinking of moving here at some point in the future, or they're just your own children who are going to grow up and move out because they can't afford to buy a house in the city that they grew up in.
Madam Chair, is Glenn Dorfman in the crowd here?
I don't believe that he is.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
I heard he's been busy in the tax committee lately, though. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine is more just, I think, comment to members. I did pass out a piece that is another point of view around this issue, which members can take back to their offices and read at another time. over the last number of years, this has obviously been my big issue, and so I frequently have had opportunities to hear speakers such as this, and I always take seriously when a broad statement is made, and one of them in the last number of years was the rail system in Salt Lake City is such a disaster, they are dismantling it. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So I called Salt Lake City, and they say, no, we're not dismantling it, we're in fact expanding it. I'm sorry I stepped out for a minute, but at the early presentation, I heard statements about San Francisco and Washington, D.C. Those happen to be two areas where I have family, so I spend a fair amount of time in those cities and on those transit systems. And I've been struck a little bit today that this presentation is kind of like the world is round and the world is flat. And I tend to believe, I think the world is round, and the critics tend to think it's flat. It is two different worldviews of reality. So it's obviously across the country, other cities have had these presentations, but what we know is every major metropolitan area is moving vigorously to provide a system of transportation choices to keep them economically competitive, and I think that is, it's only that economic competitiveness that drives our transportation discussions here too.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. O'Toole, I have a couple questions. You talked about the total annual penalty for planning, and you put forward a figure of $1.6 billion for the Twin Cities. What type of costs were included, or could you explain your formula process, or what
yes.
added to those costs?
Yes, I looked at the median home price in the Twin Cities and compared it with the median family income in the Twin Cities. Nationwide, the median home price is just a little bit more than twice the median family income. That means the median family can buy a home, spend 25% of their income on the home, on the mortgage, and pay off the mortgage in about 10 or 12 years. But in the Twin Cities, the median home price is much more than twice median family income, which means you're verging on 25 to 30 years that it takes to be able to afford to pay off a house if you're only dedicating 25% of your income towards that house. If you dedicate more, you can do it a little quicker, but what we have seen in region after region is that they adopt these plans, and then housing prices start to grow faster than incomes, and so the longer the plans are in effect, the more unaffordable it becomes. In San Francisco, they're now to the point where median home value is 14 times the mean family income, which means if you dedicate 50% of your income to housing, you will not have enough money to make the interest payments on your house. Even if you had a 100-year loan, you could not make the interest payments on your house, much less ever pay off the loan. So the key is median family income versus median home price. Normally, home builders will build to the market, but when you start restricting the market, several things happen. When you start putting in all these rules and regulations, the small home builders can't afford to keep up. They can't afford to hire lawyers and go through a big, long planning process and so on and so forth. The national home builders will stay out of your market because they want to build where they can make an easy profit, build fast. They can build houses in Houston for $65 a square foot. Here it's $150 a square foot. They are not interested in that. So you've greatly limited competition. When you limit competition, everybody knows prices go up. And so you've made your region less competitive. And that's what's going on here. The median home price is a lot more than twice the median family income, which is making housing less affordable.
And for just clarification, did you use the entire seven-county metro area?
Yes, I used the metropolitan area as defined by the Census Bureau, and I think that's all seven counties.
Okay.
Called the Minneapolis-St. Paul-Bloomington metropolitan area.
Okay. Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Well, I'm sure, Mr. O'Toole, this book, I mean, this little handout, I think this is from Representative Hausman.
Representative Anderson, I'm not sure if Mr. O'Toole was given the courtesy of a copy.
Okay, maybe you didn't. regarding a desire named streetcar. In there it says, I think in the second paragraph, it says, rail transit fails to attract new riders. I mentioned that the writer of this article says it is inappropriate to claim, as you do, that rail transit investments stunt transit ridership growth. How do you respond to?
Well, I've debated Mr. Littman several times. He obviously loves trains like I do, but he somehow lets it shade his preferences. He likes to tell people that he lives within walking distance of a bar, and he just wishes everybody lives within walking distance of a bar so there wouldn't be any drunk drivers. But I personally don't drink at all, but I don't imagine the people who do drink want to go to the same old bar every single time, so they still might get in their car sometimes, even if they all live within walking distance of a bar. Now, I don't know why he thinks that because he lives in walking distance of a bar that everybody in the world ought to do that. His idea is that transit works in New York, and so therefore it should work everywhere else. He's done his own studies that compete against my studies, and he looks selectively at a few cities. I try to look at every city. I try to gather all the data I can. I got data back to 1982 for every city in the country. I looked especially at the cities that have rail transit. I compared them with the cities that have bus transit. There are numerous cities that have bus-only transit whose transit ridership has steadily grown faster than driving. And so they are gaining market share. They're not going to be in a huge share ever, but they're gaining market share. There's not a single city that has rail transit in which transit ridership and transit passenger miles are both growing faster than driving. There's one city where ridership is growing, but transit passenger miles aren't growing faster than driving. So I don't see where you can say that rail transit is all that great compared to buses. And there are so many cities, not all of them. Transit ridership is growing in Portland, it's growing in San Diego, it's growing in Boston, and it's growing in Salt Lake City, although it was growing faster in most of those cities before they started building rail transit than it has been growing since the rail transit, except for Boston, which has always had rail transit. The fact is there are so many examples where it's not growing, where rail transit has hurt the transit rider, it's hurt increased congestion, that you're just risking a lot. If you look at the physical layout of the cities where it's not working, and you look at your physical layout of the Twin Cities, you are much more like the cities where it's not working than the cities where it is working. You're not like Boston. You don't look at all like Boston. You're not like New York. You're much more like Dallas, really. And it's really questionable to say that rail transit is working in Dallas. The commuter rail line there carries almost nobody. So Todd Littman, he's a nice guy. I think he uses data selectively, and then he turns around and accuses me of using data selectively when I select all the data I can find and look at them all.
Thank you, Manager.
Thank you. Additional questions?
Well, Manager, I was thinking, Mr. O'Toole is talking about the debt service on some of the rail lines where the sales tax was reduced, and that caused the service to be reduced and so forth. Now that same thing applies to roads and bridges. When we build those, if the sources of income are not adequate to provide the maintenance, especially when they're debt service is over 30 years, and we probably won't have the same type of cash flow from the type of debt service we're counting on, with the type of objects to supply the debt service. So what you're saying here applies equally to other forms of transportation.
Well, it doesn't apply equally because it depends on where your money is coming from. In San Jose, their money was coming from a sales tax, and sales taxes are very sensitive to recessions. Portland, we fund our light rail out of property taxes. Now that voters have twice voted down any further property taxes for light rail, they fund it out of TIF, which is property taxes, too. But property taxes are less sensitive to recessions. TIF, tax increment financing?
Now, how do you fund that?
They built the light rail where the urban renewal districts are so that they can take the tax increment finance money from the urban renewal districts for the light rail. It's a typical scheme that I don't think the people of Portland are really approving of. I'd love to tell you about that, but they probably don't have time. But that's how they're funding light rail now, is TIF and airport landing fees and stuff like that. But the point is, property taxes are not as sensitive to recessions, and so Portland isn't going to have the problem that San Jose had. If you aren't funding your light rail out of sales taxes, you won't have the problem. But highways, however, tended to be funded either out of tolls or out of gas taxes. And the data show that people drive, what happens during recessions is the growth of driving slows, but driving doesn't usually slow. If you looked at my charts, they all had a driving line, and where you saw rail declining, driving kept increasing in San Jose and in other cities. So if you fund driving out of user fees, either gas taxes or tolls, you're not going to have those kinds of problems like you do when you fund transit out of sales taxes. And of course, if you steal the user fees from the gas tax payers and give it to transit, you can also avoid that kind of a problem.
I'm not sure. You're talking about the system in New York, I think, is worn out and has to be rebuilt, the transit system. And the same thing applies to roads and bridges. They wear out, too.
Yes.
That's so cool.
Nationwide, and I know it differs by state, but nationwide, 88% to 90% of all the costs of building, operating, maintaining, law enforcement, and so on highways is paid for out of gas taxes, late mile fees, and other highway user fees.
Mm-hmm.
The 10% to 12% subsidy is a subsidy I would be glad to get rid of. I don't think we need to subsidize highways at all. But we drive so much that subsidy adds up to about a third of a penny per passenger mile. By comparison, the subsidies to transit average about 60 cents a passenger mile, which means subsidies to transit are 200 times as great as subsidies to highways. I think you can run transit and highways without subsidies. I think you might want to subsidize the low-income people and other transit-dependent people by giving them vouchers that they can use. But there's no reason why transit can't make a profit. Most transit agencies have made a profit until the 1960s when the government took them over.
Mr. Toole, I have a couple questions relative to the federal funds for transit projects, and I shared with you a copy of a letter that the FTA provided to our Commissioner of Transportation relative to the status of the North Star project, and it's my understanding that the cost-effectiveness index threshold used to be $25, that it was reduced to $22, that the current status, I believe, is $26.19 or $26.17, for North Star, and there was a number of standards that had to be met for the project. Can you talk a little bit about what has happened at the federal level for funding of these projects, why the change from the 25 to 22, and if you're aware of any projects that did not meet the cost effectiveness index that received some type of waiver or exception in order to still get funding?
All right. Just as a little background, I'll have to say that I'm not Oregon has a lot of independent voters. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. And I'm not an ardent enthusiast of most of the Bush policies. I don't know what you feel about that. But the one Bush policy that I have approved of is that last April they adopted a policy that transit projects must meet a firm cost-effectiveness ratio. And that cost-effectiveness was measured by the cost in dollars per hour, what they call hour of transportation benefit. In other words, if somebody's driving a car at 30 miles an hour, then they can ride a train at 40 miles an hour, they might save a few minutes. You add up those minutes to hours, and then you take the cost of the train or whatever the transit is and divide by the hours to get the dollar cost per hour of transportation benefit. They said any project that costs more than $25 per hour of benefit would not be funded by the FTA. Congress can overrule that. Congress immediately overruled that in the last round of transportation bill, the reauthorization bill, safety lieu, for four different transit lines. One of them was in Portland. A couple of them were in the San Francisco, I think the other three were all in the San Francisco Bay Area. One was a BART line, one was a light rail line in San Francisco.
But they did not overrule it for any other, and I haven't heard them overruling it for any other area. The Federal Transit Administration report for the North Star commuter rail that was published last November estimated that it would cost $24.90 per hour of transportation user benefit. So that's 10 cents under the threshold. So it got a recommended rating. It didn't get a no recommended rating. But the Federal Transit Administration added that they considered that the numbers to be very unreliable because there were a lot of costs that were still vague. They had not yet negotiated an agreement with Burlington Northern. They had not yet complied, Burlington Northern Santa Fe. They had not yet complied with the ADA, Americans for Disabilities Act. And there were a number of other costs that were vague and uncertain. And they didn't think that, it sounded like, they didn't think it was going to end up being cost effective. It only had to increase 10 cents to no longer be cost effective. Well, as you may know, March 6th, they sent a letter to the Metro Council saying, we've declared your North Star Light Rail a recommended project. So I'm afraid I can't tell you what happened between November and March 6th. If the costs have gone up, and that letter specifically said it's still conditional upon you reaching an agreement with Burlington Northern Santa Fe, it's still conditional upon you building in Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA compliance. And if those things increase the cost, then you could lose that recommendation. So that's where we stand today. As far as I know, Congress is not able to overturn that recommendation until the next round of transportation reauthorization. But, of course, all kinds of things happen inside the Beltway that I have no control over.
We know that feeling as well around here, too. Representative Earhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a Highway 10, that runs roughly parallel to the Northside Corridor up there.
Yes.
And would it be your recommendation then, from what you're saying, that we ought to scrap the North Star project and build Highway 10 into a freeway or something, some upgrading, considerable upgrading?
Yes, yes, I read the environmental impact statement for upgrading the Highway 10, and what they said was, it was very interesting, they said traffic is growing so fast on this highway that by the time we add new lanes to the highway, the traffic on those new lanes and the existing lanes is going to be greater than the traffic on the existing lanes today. In other words, even though we've increased the capacity by 15%, it's going to take us so long to build, we've got 50% more traffic. And to me, that means, well, maybe you better hurry up your construction and planning process, but it also means maybe you better look at a different way of metering traffic. Right now, as you know, the Highway 10 is a free road, just like most of the other freeways around here. What would the analysis have said if they had considered the alternative of a hot lane, a high occupancy toll lane, such as you already are starting to experiment with in the on the west side? If that was a hot lane, you could charge a higher toll when traffic was high, and thereby keep traffic flowing, keep it from ever being congested, moving more cars per hour at those high speeds, because as I explained, when the speeds go down, the flow capacity goes way down. And I bet they could have done significantly relieved congestion with those same lanes at very little by building in a toll component. So that would be my recommendation. Scrap the North Star Light Rail, build the new lanes, toll those lanes. There are even companies in the world, as I'm sure you know, that will be glad to build those lanes for you at their expense, provided that they're allowed to toll them. Make them private. This is happening all over the world. I was in France last spring, and most of the highways in France are rapidly being privatized or leased to private operators and tolled, and it's a very successful operation.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You didn't say anything about the rail service in Europe, since you just brought up Europe. Is that in such a mess as we are here with our rail service? Or?
Ms. Filtzel.
That's a very good question. Europe has been devoting huge subsidies to rail service, and they tax automobiles heavily. According to a report I just read, automobile drivers pay 320 billion euros in tax each year, and they're spending only 100 billion euros on those highways. By comparison, rail riders pay 40 billion euros in fares, and they spend over 105 billion euros on rail every year. Okay, with all that money going into rail, what's happening? Well, it turns out in 1980, intercity rail and rail transit carried a total of 9% of all travel. It was 8% was carried by intercity rail, and another 2% carried by rail transit. By the year 2000, that had dropped to 6% because people are driving more and more every year despite the high taxes, which of course makes gasoline more than $5 a gallon. Per capita driving is rapidly increasing. Per capita auto ownership is rapidly increasing. The Germans actually own more cars per capita than Americans do. The French, the Italians, and the English are at about 95% as many cars per capita. They do not yet drive as many miles as we do per capita, but their per capita driving is growing faster than ours. They're catching up. So all the social engineering, all the taxes on cars, all the subsidies to rail are not changing the picture. Europe is fast becoming another America. They're sprawling. They're Paris, central Paris, has lost 75% of its population because people are moving out to the suburbs. The cities are losing density. They're becoming, and the suburbs of Paris and Stockholm are indistinguishable from the suburbs of the Twin Cities.
Representative Earhart, one more, and I know that Representative Hornstein sure. and Hausman have questions as well, and then we need to get to Representative Magnus' bill.
You mentioned the $5 a gallon cost of gasoline and higher over there.
Yes.
And some other parts of the world, and most of that is taxes.
That's right.
So to consider that we may have some additional road building to be done here in the state, and we pay the lowest gas tax in the world in our area, and in the according to the charts I've seen, so another 10 cents or 15 or 20 cents a gallon to help complete those extra roads like Highway 10 and so forth, would probably not even be a burden on the people that want to use the roads.
Well, I'm sure there would be a political outcry, but I don't think it would change people's travel habits. It might lead people to buy a Toyota instead of a Lexus next time. And that's what happens, is if people buy a little bit less luxurious car when gas prices go up, they don't drive less. But I don't recommend increasing gas taxes. Gas taxes are very problematic. For one thing, they don't give people a signal that it's more expensive to drive at rush hour than at other times of the day. You can do that with tolls. You can charge a higher toll during rush hour. You can charge a higher toll for more expensive roads and a lower toll for less expensive roads. And you can't do that with gas taxes. The other problem with gas taxes is that cars are getting more fuel efficient all the time. When you fill up your car at the pump today, you only pay half the gas tax adjusted for inflation as, I like to say, when your parents filled up their cars at the pump in 1960. So gas taxes don't keep up. Tolls can keep up, and that's why I recommend tolls instead of gas taxes. I'm with you all the way on making sure that roads pay their way. I don't think there should be any subsidies to roads, and I do think there should be some subsidies to low-income people and other transit-dependent people to ride the transit. But I don't think the transit agency should get the subsidies. I think the riders should get the subsidies.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. O'Toole, earlier in your presentation, you had talked about the relationship between declining bus transit ridership and the presence of rail transit. And, you know, here in Minnesota, we can document, even before the light rail line was built, that we had declining ridership based on, I think, two very important factors. One was a direct relationship between cuts and funding for bus transit, as well as we had two labor disputes in our system in the last 10 years. And the most recent one several years ago lasted 44 days, and we had a significant drop in ridership following that dispute. But I guess I would just wonder if in these other cities, we can trace the declining transit ridership to these other factors, which, again,
even completely independent of the presence of rail, if you were to do a graph here, you would have seen that transit ridership line going down even before the rail was introduced. I guess a comment on the other variables that lead to declining bus transit. And again, here, direct relationship between state cuts and other cuts to the system and the labor dispute.
Mr. O'Toole.
For at least one of those labor disputes, the recent one, was related to the rail transit line, because the bonding authorities said, we're not going to be willing to bond you if you give your labor an blank check for health benefits. And so Met Council went to the labor unions and said, we have to remove the blank check for health benefits out of the our contracts, and the labor unions went on strike for 44 days. So we've seen similar things happen elsewhere, where in Los Angeles, for example, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, Transportation Authority, was told they had to buy several hundred new buses to restore bus service to the minority neighborhoods, and they couldn't afford to do that and still operate the rail lines they'd already built, even though they canceled several proposed lines. And so they went to the labor unions and said, we're paying you time and a half and double time for working 60, 80 hours a week. How about if you just work 40 hours a week and we'll hire more employees and we won't have to pay time and a half? And the employees went on strike for a month, and nobody noticed any increase in congestion, of course, because so few people ride transit, but as a percentage of the total. But again, that labor dispute was directly related to the rail transit. So I'm not saying that all declines in ridership are related to rail transit. If you look at cities across the country, you find some very poorly managed bus operations where that transit ridership is declining. You look at cities that are decentralizing. The people move to the suburbs, now the jobs are moving to the suburbs. And transit doesn't serve suburban jobs very well, especially when you have large buses or trains or things like that. Jitney transit is an excellent way of serving suburban jobs, and jitney transit is illegal in almost every city because the transit unions don't want to have to compete against non-union jitney bus owner-operated buses. So I think you can do a lot better job cost-effectively, and that necessarily means in almost every case that rail transit isn't going to be part of the picture because it's never cost-effective. As I say, if there is one that is, I would be in favor of it. I love trains, but I haven't ever found one that is in the United States.
Representative Hausman, did you have a question? I know you had your arm up earlier.
Yeah,
and
just very quickly, in the continuing the line of the world is round, the world is flat, the speaker suggested we compare ourselves to Dallas rather than San Francisco and New York, and I agree. And this committee chose Dallas because of that. That was before most of you were. It was when Carol Molnau and Tom Workman were on the committee. And what I heard the speaker say is nobody was riding the train, but our particular experience that day was when we left our hotel to start our tour, the first train pulled up and the cars were too full. We could not get on them, so we waited for the next train. And as Houston watched what was happening to, again, the economic health of Dallas, Houston, which had been heavily depending on bus rapid transit, said, we've got to expand our transportation choices or Dallas is going to have us for lunch economically. The one thing that I thought might be helpful for you to be aware of in our state, you indicated that private companies will happily come in and build the toll roads as long as they can charge and receive the tolls. As I understand, our MnDOT, in fact, was given the directive and tried bidding, and their experience was that, in fact, that was not the case, that the companies that would build the roads, they would build it, but we, the state taxpayers, would still have to help subsidize the cost of building, that they couldn't make it work. So our experience here is slightly different than yours.
Well, I'd like to see that study. I just put the transit ridership graph for Dallas back up. You can see in the early 1980s, before they started planning rail transit, they had very rapid growth in bus ridership. Then as they're building transit ridership, as they're building rail transit, the ridership just flattened out. No growth at all. Then they started opened their first light rail line, and they again started growing ridership, but the growth is not as fast as it was when they just had buses. And they doubled the miles of light rail, and got essentially no new riders, the same as St. Louis. So, yes, you might ride a light rail train that's full during rush hour, but that doesn't mean it's really cost effective. It doesn't mean it's helping transit riders. It doesn't mean that transit ridership is growing in the Dallas area. If your transit ridership isn't growing, you're certainly not getting people off the road. And you can see there's a black line on here showing driving. That's growing far faster than transit ridership.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mr. O'Toole. And we have to move on to our final bill on our committee agenda today, and we appreciate the time that you've taken before the committee. Members, the next item on our agenda is House File 3398, which will be laid over for possible inclusion in a transportation omnibus bill. Representative Magnus, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. I'll move this bill. I would prefer to go to the floor, Madam Chair, but it's our understanding we'll go to the omnibus holdover for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the hearing time. And House File 3398, I'll talk. It's just a short portion of the bill, but Mr. Burris did a good job of when the bill summary basically is increasing the eligibility criteria from 200,000 to 300,000, so that towns that have that net tax capacity under 300,000 would be reimbursed for engineering costs over $10,000 for towns and bridges, town bridges and culverts. We also do include a inflationary language in there, the annual implicit price deflator in the bill. Also with me today, I have Mr. Kent Solom to talk from the Minnesota Association of Townships to talk further about the bill.
Thank you, Representative Magnus. Can you tell me the last time when the $200,000 figure was put into law? How long has this number stood? Mr. Solom, if you'll state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Solom with the Minnesota Association of Townships. The $200,000 number is what the law started with when it was established, I believe, in 2000. This number has been there since this law has been on the books. And if I may, the reason that we are now seeking the increase, some of our members brought to our attention, at the time that this law was originally adopted, it applied to just under 700 townships in the state. Due to inflation, that number has dropped now to closer to 500, so 200 townships have lost their eligibility to use this flexible use of the account. And by raising it to 300,000, we raise it back to the 700 threshold in rounded numbers. We won't get into the specific numbers. But the 300 threshold raises it back to the number of eligible communities that qualified at the time the law was originally passed. And so that's why we chose the 300 threshold. I understand that there is concern that has been raised about the inflationary number. I was just having a conversation during the last presentation with Mr. Jonas. And if it would make, we had simply put the inflationary number in there, hoping that we wouldn't have to spend committee time 5 years out or something looking to readjust it. We thought it was a simplifier. We used language that the state auditor's office had put in on language dealing with local government audits. But if it would make the committee more comfortable, and it would help MnDOT's comfort with the bill, we would be amenable to deleting the language on 2.17 to 2.20. Which I believe is the indexing number. We thought we were helping, but if it's going to cause concerns, we're more than willing to take that out.
And we appreciate that flexibility, and given this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, we have some time to work on that. Did MnDOT want to comment on this bill at all? Are there any questions of the bill author or testifier? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify against House File 3398? Seeing none, Representative Magnus, you want to renew your motion that House File 3398 be laid over for possible inclusion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll make that motion.
Thank you very much. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And seeing no additional business to come before the committee, we will be meeting next week. We'll likely put together an omnibus bill on the 11th. We're working on some room arrangements. We may have to have one meeting either next Thursday or the following Tuesday that would be longer in duration than our normal meeting time, but we will keep you posted. With that, the committee is adjourned.